glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, 2nd chapter, text 17. So, doesn't look like one we can chant together. Does he have it broken down up there? Can we chant it? Sorry? No, but does he have it broken down so that we can chant it together? Yeah? Oh, okay.
Maybe can somebody kind of spin it around?
Okay. Iti lala nanu. Let's try it again. Iti lala nanu nayati visarado. Gramya vaidag dahayaya parihapyasaya. Tam vibhudha. Vadhum vibhudamatir abhissa bhajayayamasha iti lala nanu nayati visarado ramya vaidagd yaya paribhasyat Paribasayatam Vibhuda Vidhum Vibhuda Matir Abhisabhya Jayam Asha Sri Suguvacha Iti Lala Nanu Yatnayati Visarado Ramya vaidag yaya paribhasayatam Vibhuda vatum vibhuda matir Abhisabhajaya masha. Somebody else want to try? Sri Sukuvacha. Sarado Ramya Vadag Yaya Paribhashyatam Vibhuda Vadum Vibhuda Matir Dear Abbas. Any other brave souls want to attempt this? Ladies? Okay. Sri Sukavacha. Sri Sukadev Goswami said, Iti, thus, Lalana, woman, Anunaya, in winning over, Ati Visarada, very expert, Gramya, Vaidagyaya, expert in fulfilling one's material desires. Paribhasaya, by selected words. Tam, her. Vibhuda Vadhum, that celestial girl. Vibhuda Mati, Agnidra, who possessed intelligence like that of the demigods. Abhisabhajayamasha, gain the favor of. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Sukadeva Goswami continued, Maharaj Agnidra, whose intelligence was like that of a demigod, knew the art of flattering women to win them to his side. He therefore pleased that celestial girl with his lusty words and gained her favor. Purport. Since King Agnidra was a devotee, he actually had no attraction for material enjoyment. But because he wanted a wife for progeny, and Lord Brahma had sent Purvachiti for this purpose, he expertly pleased her with flattering words. Women are attracted by a man's flattering words. One who is expert in this art of flattery is called Vidagdha. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminita Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nivashesha Sunyavadi Paschacharya Shatarine Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhuna Chananda Shri Advaita Gadadar Shri Vasudi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So it's mentioned here in the purport that Maharaj Anigra, it says he expertly pleased her, referring to Purvachiti, with flattering words. Women are attracted by a man's flattering words. So this is not something that the brahmachari should try at home. Or out on Sankirtan, for that matter. But actually, no, this is because it's actually mentioned here that Maharaj Anigra, he said he actually had no attraction for material enjoyment. So and also he had a service motive. You know, he wanted progeny for the purpose of, further populating the universe. And he knew that Lord Brahma had sent this particular girl for that purpose. So now he was just going through the motions. He was just, doing what was necessary to continue, on with his service there of getting a wife and producing some Krishna-conscious children. And he was confident that he wasn't in danger of falling down from, Vedic principles. As I mentioned here, he had no attraction for material enjoyment. So if somebody is in that category, then you can make use of this. It's actually quite an effective tool for preaching, flattering in general, but you have to be very careful. I mean, there is an instruction by Prabodhananda Saraswati. I can't remember the Sanskrit, but Prabhupada would translate it something to this effect that, when you meet somebody, you tell them, oh, you are so intelligent, you are so wealthy, you are so good-looking, et cetera, et cetera. Now, please forget everything you know, and just consider the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. So Prabhupada, in elaborating upon that, would say, yeah, that's the principle. Flatter him like anything. You flatter the person like anything, and then you ask him, please, now consider this philosophy of Lord Chaitanya. So it is a good preaching strategy, but it has to be used with a lot of discretion. As I said, especially if you're, a brahmacharya on Sankirtan, you got to be careful because Prabhupada said you have to catch the big fish but don't get wet. So if you're confident that you can catch the big fish but not get wet, then okay, but if you feel yourself getting wet, then stop. And you can just appreciate how Krishna is most expert at this. A name for Krishna is Vidagdha Madhava. And because one who is expert in the art of flattery is called Vidagdha, so that's a name for Krishna, Vidagdha Madhava. So anyway, the main thing though is that this is preaching. We can use this for preaching. Actually, those of us who do book distribution, we know we use this principle, not necessarily using it on to attract women for the purpose of, but just in general, flattery is can be very effective. People. It's a form of service, actually. I mean, if you try to stop somebody by asking them a question, you're asking for service. Excuse me, are you from local or from out of town? Well, you're asking them to answer your question, so you're asking them to render you service. But when you offer somebody a compliment or you flatter them, you're rendering service. You're rendering service to their false ego there, or to them in general, and they take it as such. They feel like, oh, when was the last time somebody paid me a compliment? So they're ready to relax and drop their defenses a little bit and prepare to talk to you. So, it can be something that's really good. But the most important thing, because talking about preaching now, is that our most powerful asset is not that, flattery or any kind of material trick or technique. We're not depending upon that. Actually, back in 1975, Prabhupada was in Atlanta. And at that time, a lot of the book distributors were there. Probably Savas was there. Probably Sir was there. I wasn't, but anyway, they might have been. And Prabhupada met with the book distributors, and the spokesman for the book distributors said to Prabhupada, "Prabhupada, when we go around to the temples, a lot of times they ask us to give class on book distribution technique." And Prabhupada said, so what do you tell them? And he said, well, actually, Prabhupada, we tell them first they have to chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulative principles and, you know, read your books and attend the programs, and, you know, like that. And then Prabhupada interrupted him and said, yes, that is our only technique, to become very devout followers of the rules and regulations. So, you know, Prabhupada was emphasizing at that time and in general that that was the most important thing. Purity is the force. Purity is the force. And so, you know, we're not depending upon any material expertise or sales tactics or anything like that. In our preaching, it's purity. We know if we follow strictly, then the purity will be there, and Krishna will empower us to be able to attract people who want to engage in devotional service. So, as I said, our greatest asset is that, you know, not some tricks or anything like that, but our greatest asset is that Krishna consciousness is the absolute truth. That's our greatest asset. And I like, when I'm preaching to people, I try to take advantage. Actually, I try to remind myself of that, and I try to take advantage of that. The very first thing I do after I'm able to, like, you know, stop a person and try to establish a little rapport with them is I show them the pictures. I say, here, look, check this out. This is, you've heard of karma? And the person goes, yeah. So, yeah, whatever they say, I say, here's a picture of it. And I show, here, this is a man with a bull's head and a bull with a man's head. It's showing how the roles get reversed. And you get various reactions to that picture. Some people go, youch, like that. Or some people go, whoa, you know. Or some people just kind of go, yeah, they appreciate it. And then I show them changing bodies, and I show them, here, this picture's showing how the soul continues even after the body's finished. And to us, that's real old hat. You know, gross, you know. But to a lot of people we're meeting, that's like a revolutionary idea. You know, so, well, they stop and think about it. You can see, like, because, you know, it's something they might have heard about as a kid when they were in school or when they went to, or sometime in their life. But, you know, it's really nothing they probably give serious thought to, but it's actually a very, you know, it's a very profound thought. The soul continues even after the body's finished. And I was just looking at the Bhagavad Gita this morning. I was looking. You know, that verse, Dehino Sminyata Dehe Komanam Yovanan Jarat, Tata Dehantara Praptir, which means that the soul similarly passes on to another body at death. It's a revolutionary thought. So I like to present that to people and just, you know, feel confident that, hey, this is the absolute truth. And, you know, if this person's fortunate, he's going to be able to appreciate that. And he's going to be able to appreciate that this is a book or, you know, this is a philosophy worth checking out a little bit further. And he's going to, you know, pursue it. He's going to take a book, give a donation, or give this philosophy further serious consideration. And I think that's justified. I think that's the proper response that, you know, for people to make. Because, you know, we're not out there just trying to share a bunch of claims with people. You know, there's a difference between a claim and a fact. You know, somebody, this is like an objection that a lot of people have to Krishna consciousness and religion in general, and that it's just a lot of claims. You know, you have your Krishna, you have your claims, you know, your beliefs, in other words. That's another way of saying that whole thing. You know, your claim is that, okay, we're not the body, we're the soul, and that, you know, you're Krishna's supreme personality of Godhead, you're eternal servant, you're eternal servants, but that's just your claim, that's your belief. Or it's just a claim. Just like the Christians, they have their claims, and the Muslims, they have their claims, and the Jews have their claims. And that's true. You know, it's true, but it's more than just a claim, or at least we can present it as such, and as we can respond to that by saying, you know what, okay, you're right, it is a claim, but it's a claim that can be substantiated. There is a certain amount of empiric evidence that can to support this claim, and then you can mention to them about, and I do this, you know, if the person's, you know, seems like they're a little bit interested, a little bit, you know, willing to listen, you could just mention to them that, you know, hey, there's empiric evidence. There's scientists who've done research with a phenomenon of young children who spontaneously remember a previous lifetime. You know, these are kids that hit the age of like 1.5 and 2 years old. When they first start talking, they're talking about, you know, a previous personality they remember being. And they present a whole lot of details, and a lot of these are verifiable. So, and I say, you don't take my word for it. You can check this out for yourself. And I refer them to a website on the internet. You know, I just say, go Google. Everybody knows Google, right? Type in the name Ian Stevenson, type in University of, it's the first website, and then scroll down a little bit, go to Jim Tucker. This is actually a protege of his, somebody who's kind of carrying on his work, and he talks for about 20, 25 minutes, a little video, you know, describing his work. And if you watch that, you're going to be convinced that this is something that's really happening. Check it out. These guys are mainstream scientists. They're not Buddhists. They're not Hindus. They've got no religious agenda that they're trying to, you know, put forward here to get, you know, it's not like any, they're not interested in getting people into reincarnation per se. They're just, you know, presenting the, what they think is the best explanation for this phenomenon that they've been scientifically investigating for, at least in the case of, Ian Stevenson, for like 30 years. So you can just present to that, like, you know, really quickly. And, And you can make the point also that, okay, you know, so there is, and they could, well, they might respond and saying, okay, but even if I check that out, and even if I am convinced by this, you know, your empiric evidence that there is, you know, reincarnation is something that's happening, that still doesn't prove the rest of the stuff you guys are saying. It doesn't prove that, you know, God's a bluish cowherd boy who expanded himself into 16,108 forms, and, you know, to marry the queens of Dwarka or to dance with the gopis and the Rasa dancer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't, you know, and it's true. They're right. We can't, there isn't external empiric evidence to support all the different aspects of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. There isn't. But there is, as we just mentioned, empiric evidence supports some of the very, you know, the basic core or foundational ideas, such as we're not this material body. So at least, you know, that should give somebody an impetus or inspire somebody to give this worldview or this philosophy further serious consideration, especially when you consider that, like, well, as I said, let's, you know, assume that this person accepts on the basis of, you know, the little bit of empiric evidence that you provide them with. You know, they go do their homework, they do their research, and they come back and they say, yeah, that was pretty impressive, I got to admit. I did this with my son, you know. I had him sit down and watch that video, and he's basically kind of very skeptical at this point, but he had to admit. He said, yeah, I got to admit, that's pretty impressive. I said, so? He said, well, I'm going to have to think about this a bit further, you know. And that's what any, you know, a fair-minded, reasonable, intelligent person will do. And you can present them and say, that's what we're asking you to do. You know, that's because if you let's, you know, just look at, let's look at the overall picture, okay? So this is, you know, good quality empiric evidence supporting that reincarnation is something that happens, okay? So let's put it on the table here. You know, it's something as a you know, as a admissible evidence, so to speak, like they do in a court. You know, provincially, nothing. I can't think of the word, but it's, you know, it's a fact, okay? So. Okay, so where does that, you know, where does it fit in with the whole understanding of life? Does it fit in with the understanding of life we get from modern science? No. Because according to modern science, you know, when you're dead, that's the end of everything. Because according to modern science, the mind is like a product of a healthy brain. If you're alive and your brain is, you know, in good health, then you have a mind and you're aware, you have consciousness. That's what's, you know, responsible for your ability to experience anything. When your brain stops working, that's the end of experience. So therefore, when you're dead, your brain stops working, that's the end of everything. That's the worldview of modern science. So it doesn't fit in with that worldview. You can't take that piece of the puzzle and put it in there. You know, can you put it in the worldview of Christianity, say, or Islam, or, you know, any of these other great wisdom traditions? Well, maybe Buddhism, you know, because they believe in reincarnation, but I don't think they do in the same way as us, but certainly not Christianity and certainly not Islam. Because Christians believe that, you know, it's appointed for man to die once and then the judgment. So, you know, forget about that. And even, you know, some of their great quote-unquote acharyas, like St. Augustine, said reincarnation is ridiculous. So it's not part of that worldview. It maybe used to be way back in the very early Christianity, like in the first couple hundred years before they decided at the Council of Nice to make it an anathema or a heresy, you know, punishable by death, and which they did. They killed a lot of early Christians because they continued to believe in reincarnation, but it's certainly not any longer. So it doesn't fit in that worldview. It doesn't fit in the Islamic worldview. It doesn't fit in the scientific worldview. But does it fit in the Krishna conscious worldview? Yeah, like a hand in a glove. You know, as I said, it's one of the core foundational ideas of Krishna conscious philosophy, that we're not this material body. You know, we're eternal spiritual beings, and et cetera, et cetera. So just on the basis of that, you could say, hey, okay, so, you know, just give this philosophy some further serious consideration. And, as I said, if the person's fair-minded and reasonable, and they'll have to agree to do that. And what does that mean, further serious consideration? Well, it doesn't mean that, you know, you go off and with a, you know, full set of Prabhupada's books and spend a year in seclusion and read them, although that's not a bad idea. Nothing wrong with that. That would be nice. But you don't have to take it that far, you know. Just to pick a Bhagavad Gita up, you know, and read it a bit, and you familiarize yourself with some of the other you know, basic ideas of this philosophy. Actually, can somebody grab me the Bhagavad Gita there off the shelf? I'll need it for the next thing here. And, you know, such as, okay, you know, all right, we're not the material body, what are we? We're eternal spiritual beings, and what's the rest of it? Okay, we're eternal servants of Krishna. And according to the Bhagavad Gita explains it, you know, the way, if you want further confirmation of this, then, you know, there is a way to get further confirmation and verification of that as well. Just like I mentioned, is, you know, we have a certain amount of empiric evidence to externally verify the Vedic worldview. And there is it's a process presented in the Bhagavad Gita that enables us to internally verify the Vedic worldview. In other words, we have a certain amount of external verification for this philosophy that, you know, we've been given, and there is 100% complete internal verification available, but you have to have the qualification to really take full advantage of it. And in case you're, you know, wondering what I'm referring to, I'll read it to you. It's that verse, this is described in different ways, but I found the nicest description of this process of internal verification is presented by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says, Ado Shraddha Tata Sadhu Sadhu Sangha Ta Bhajana Kriya Tato Narta Navritti Shyat Tato Nishta Ruchistata Ata Shaktis Tata Bhavas Tata Premad Dhyan Premab Yudanchati Sadakanam Ayam Premna Pradurbhave Bhavet Krama. Translation, in the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. Okay, so here it is. This is the process for internal verification of the whole philosophy of Krishna consciousness. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master. And under his instructions, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. By execution of devotional service, under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from material attachment. In other words, it's basically up to this point is saying, okay, you just do like this, this, and this, and this is what you're going to experience. You know, as you come forward, you associate with a spiritually elevated person, you take initiative from a bona fide spiritual master, you follow the instructions for bhakti yoga under his guidance, and then this is what happens. And then you can observe for yourself. If this is happening, then you know you got it. Then you know you got the absolute truth. You judge a process by the result. So if you're experiencing this happening, you can preach this to a person, you can tell it to yourself, then you know you got it. It says here, by execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment. So, you know, we or they should, a person seriously practicing bhakti yoga should experience it. That at least is gradually happening. It might not happen like that the very next second, but it's something you're going to experience that's gradually happening. You're becoming free from all material attachment. You're going to attain steadiness and self-realization. You're going to acquire a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. That taste is going to lead you further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. So you can present to somebody that, okay, this is all you got to do. You know, it's very, very simple. You know, slow it down. Okay, it's very, very simple. You just, you know, read this book, you know, familiarize yourself with the rest of the philosophy, and then make an experiment. Try the process. Very simple. Trying the process means that step one is chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If you want to get a little bit more serious, and if you really want to see if, you know, make a serious experiment, follow these four rules and regulations. No illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling. If you just do those two things, if you seriously try the chanting, and you seriously follow those regulative principles, you're going to experience things changing in your life. You're going to experience a transformation in your consciousness. That's our claim, you know. And you don't take my word for it. Try it for yourself. And if anybody does try that, I mean, our philosophy is that they will experience that. So that's, you know, it's, for me, it seems like a bit of a no-brainer. I mean, I don't know. Everybody here, please help me out if I'm missing something. But it seems to me like we got a strong case. You know, we have a philosophy that can be supported by a certain amount of external empiric evidence. Certain aspects, for certain very important aspects of the worldview, can be supported by empiric evidence, and then, you know, which is warrants giving the whole, the whole philosophy further serious consideration. That further serious consideration means engaging in the process, and then the process is internally verifiable. If somebody engages in the process, you know, gives it a good shot, then they'll experience how there is something here. You know, this is not just a bluff, that there's some, you know, this is a genuine, this is the absolute truth, because, you know, the process works. You judge a process by the result. So, so preaching is our most important business. We should, of course, practice seriously ourselves. If we practice seriously ourselves, we'll feel convinced, and then that's kind of necessary. You've got to really feel convinced about the whole thing yourself in order to be able to preach effectively, and then preach. And it's not like you have to, you know, be like a great Vedic scholar before you can start preaching. Anybody who's chanting 16 rounds, following the four regulative principles, and, you know, just doing the basic stuff that we already do, you know, coming to class, reading the books a bit, that's qualification. You know, you're qualified to be a preacher. And you don't really have to have, it's nice if you have more qualification, if you're a real scholar and you know the philosophy inside and out, wonderful. That much the better. But if you don't, just go for it anyway. Prabhupada used to give the example, just like during a time of, this is an emergency in other words, just like during times of war, you know, they don't just pick out the guys who are martial artists or, you know, anybody who's got two arms and two legs and can move a little bit, okay, you're drafted. You know, you got in World War II, that's what they did. They took the boys off the farms, you know, 17, 18 year old guys that never even saw a gun or saw a city or anything like that. You know, they said, okay, you're a soldier now. They gave them a little training, put a weapon in the hand and shipped them across the ocean and, you know, plunked them in front of some Japanese or some German. That's how it works. So it's in a time of emergency, it's every able-bodied man, woman, and child has to come forward and do what they can do. So it's like that now. This is the Kali Yuga. You know, it's things are getting worse by the moment. But at the same time, this happens to be the Kali Yuga that Lord Chaitanya appeared in 500 years ago. That only happens once in a thousand Kali Yugas, correct? Yeah, because Sahasra Yuga Paryantan. You know, only Krishna appears once in a day of Lord Brahma. In the day of Lord Brahma, there's a thousand cycles of the four yugas. And in that same, you know, day of Lord Brahma that Lord Krishna appears, Lord Chaitanya appears 4,500 years later. So this is that one. So this is a big chance for the, you know, people, the living entities who have got human bodies in Kali Yuga to do something other than get a one-way ticket to go to hell. And, you know, we have to be instrumental in that process of trying to help them do something other than, you know, go into the lower species for a really long time. Or, you know, even worse. So, and it can be done. I just got back from India, everybody knows, you know, and I, you know, it's kind of like, sometimes I guess here in the West, if we're preaching, you can get a little bit discouraged or a little bit disappointed because it's very hard to make devotees here. I know myself, now in retrospect I could see I'd fallen into this mentality of okay, I'm just going to have to be satisfied just to distribute books, but I don't know if I'll ever see anybody become a devotee because it just doesn't seem like that's what happens around here, you know? And I was kind of, you know, accepting that, like, oh, I guess that's just the way it is, you know? And people don't really become devotees, but you just got to preach a lot and give out a lot of books and that's, you know, that's as good as it gets or something. But no, I don't, that's, anyway, in India I saw that, at least that's not the case worldwide. I had, just before, the last place I visited when I was, over there was Chaupati, the temple that was started by Radhanath Maharaj about, I guess it was about 15 years ago. And that was an amazing eye-opening experience for me. I was like, really? I mean, first off, the first thing when you first get, even before you get there, you experience the culture there, the Vaishnav culture there, because, you know, they have somebody come and pick you up at the airport, right, you know, and help you back there. Okay, but then when you get to the temple, as soon as you walk in there, it's kind of set up like the Krishna Balaram temple in Vrindavan. You know, approximately, you know, there's a courtyard and then, you know, there's a little bit of it. And then there's a temple back a little bit, right? So then there's half some small property and then the temple. So as soon as you walk in the gate there, you know, it's kind of like there's these really attractive murtis about the different incarnations of Krishna and some, you know, dioramas, behind like glass cases, you know, something like that, illustrating different points of the philosophy. And they're really nicely done. And then when you go into the temple room itself is really beautiful. Really beautiful. I mean, it's, you know, you're actually impressed by the beauty of the temple room itself. And of course, the deities are beautiful. But then the other thing is that all the devotees are nice. They're really nice. You know, you really like from, not just the people, from top to bottom, you experience like a real, like real welcome. You really feel welcome. And, and everybody's very, you know, friendly and, very respectful. And they're very helpful too. They're trying to like make sure, you know, you have everything you need, are you comfortable, is there any service I can do for you like that? And it's just like, it's right across the board. You know, whoever you meet, they're like that. They're all like that. And, it's Radhanath Maharaj is kind of, they've imbibed that of course from Radhanath Maharaj, who emphasizes that. When I commented upon this phenomena to one of the devotees there, what a nice reception, you know, you folks are given here, they said, yeah, well, Radhanath Maharaj said to us in a class, he said, it's not the classes that make people come back. He said, it's the welcome, it's the respect, and it's the service. See, that was what he was emphasizing to all the devotees there, that's what's, you know, more important than just like, of course, his classes are fabulous as well. But aside from that, that's what he's trying to teach everybody, that that's what's, you know, really, that's their preaching. That's an important part of their preaching, to make everybody feel really welcome, to treat everybody with a lot of respect, and to make sure that they've, you know, that you're assisting them in any way possible that they need to be assisted in order to help them have a good experience while they're there. And the thing is, it works. I mean, I got there, first of all, I think I got there on a Friday night. The next day was, they were celebrating his Vyas Puj. It wasn't actually, it was actually a couple months earlier, but because Jai Pataka Maharaj was not feeling very well still at that point, Radhanath Maharaj didn't want to have his Vyas, observe his Vyas Puja while Jai Pataka Maharaj was still in, you know, serious condition like that. So they postponed it, and they did it just a couple weekends ago. So, for starters, it was like, I was amazed. They set up this big pandal on Cross Maidan. It was the same park where Radhanath Maharaj first met Prabhupada back in 1970. And it was this big, huge pandal. It was kind of like, I don't know, it was huge. I can't like off the top of my head just, you know, compare it to any size here. But anyway, the whole thing was filled. It must have been at least 5,000 devotees there. You see? And the thing is, like, you know, the devotees there, they're not like, you know, coming and just standing around and gawking kind of devotees. And all the devotees there that come to any, to all these functions, they're into it. They're into it. You know, I'll mention it now. You go to the Sunday feast, you know, and the guests are dancing and chanting more than the devotees, the brahmacharis who live in the ashram. And they're not just coming like, oh, well, like, you know, I used to be a devotee. Now, I guess I'm kind of still a devotee, but I'm not into, I'll just go along. I got, you know, it's not, their mood is like, they're really into it. And, so there was 5,000 people at this Vyas Puja. And they were all either disciples of Radhanath Maharaj or aspiring. So that was pretty impressive to see that. But I thought maybe this is just a one-off thing. But then the next day was a Sunday feast. That was Saturday. And then Sunday, you couldn't, the whole temple, not just the temple, the whole property was packed with devotees. It was like standing in a subway during rush hour. You know, it was like packed. You couldn't get in the temple room. And so much so that they would brought, you know, underneath the temple room was on the first floor of the building, like there was the, you know, ground floor and then the first floor. They had videos and they had like, you know, screens. So some of the people could, whoever could fit, you know, whoever got there first could be in the temple room. Then everybody else had to be downstairs and they had to watch the class and the kirtan and everything on the screens. You know, they would broadcast it for them like that outside. And, you know, it was just packed. There was about 2,500 people there for the Sunday feast program. And there would have been more probably, but people just know that, well, you can't fit in, so they probably, a lot of people don't go. So there was that many people, and as I said, they were into it. At least all the ones I saw in the temple room and like that, you know, they were dancing. At least, you know, jumping up and down, that's about all they had room to do. But they were really enthusiastic. And then I found out from this devotee, I was staying with a family there, and this Grihastha couple, and the man was telling me, his name was Radhapati Das, he was telling me that they have... he was a counselor. This was the service he did, aside from a little deity worship. And he had a group of about 60 people. They were grihasthas and their, you know, grihastha couples and their families. And he met with them once a week at their homes, you know, and they'd have a program. And he would like, it would be like an istagosti, and he would just kind of like talk with them. He'd give a little talk, and then he'd ask for people, okay, well, you know, how are you doing in your Krishna consciousness? Anybody having any problems? Anybody have any things they want to discuss? So he was counseling a group of 60 people, and he mentioned to me he was only one of 60 counselors like that. So, you know, 60 times 60 is 3,600, right? Now, that's 3,600. And these, you know, as I said, these people are into it. They're, from what I can understand from him, these are people who are chanting 16 rounds and following the four regulative principles. And then aside from that, there's another group. They have, like, these bases. What they do is they rent apartments in different parts of Bombay. About, some of them are, like, probably about, you know, between 45 minutes and an hour and a half away from the temple. They rent an apartment. And then fellows who are, they want to be devotees, but they don't, you know, because they're very, it's not easy to just, it's not like here, you know, you can't just walk in the temple and become part of a brahmachari program there. You kind of like have to qualify for it first. So a lot of these fellows, they're working jobs already, or they're finishing up their school. But the temple rents apartments. They've actually rented 17 such apartments. I went to one of these programs. And, the fellows who are working or finishing up their school, they, about 10 of them live in that apartment. They live like brahmacharis. And the brahmachari ashram there, you know, sometimes maybe devotees here might feel like, well, you know, Dwarka is nice, but you don't get much facility. Man, you don't know what you got. Over there, there's no such thing as a room. Nobody has a room. You get a locker and a spot on the floor. It's just like the old days when, you know, we first joined here in America. You have a locker and a spot on the floor. And you know, there's a big communal shower and toilet like that. And they live the same way in those apartments. There's no furniture. There's just a, you know, a kitchen, a bathroom. By the way, the temple hires a cook. They have a full-time cook there, so, because these guys are all working full-time, so they just come back and the cook makes some prasadam and breakfast and like that. So anyway, they have a locker and they just sleep on the floor. They do the full morning program. They go to work all day and they come back and they have prasadam. And it's mandatory that every Sunday they go to the Sunday feast program. And they do. Happily. It's not like, you know, they're into it. So there's 17 such apartments like that, an average of about 12 fellas, you know, 12 men in each apartment. So it's about another 200. And then aside from that, outside those two programs, you know, right, so it's up about 3,800. There's about another 1,000, 1,500 people, what they call friends of Lord Krishna. And they're just people who come to the Sunday feast. It was, you know, described to me that some of them have been coming for years and years and years. And, you know, but they're not part of a counseling group or like that, but they're, you know, they're devotees. They're into it. So that adds up to 5,000, which is what I saw at the Vyas Puja. So, you know, the biggest problem there is that they're expanding. They're making more devotees all the time, and they don't know what to do. That's the biggest problem there. That they don't know where. Because, you know, the real estate in Bombay, somebody told me, is as expensive, if not more expensive, than New York City. So there's no question of, you know, really buying more real estate around there. Or they could, but it's going to be difficult. Anyway, so that's their problem. You know, they're trying to figure out, they're scratching their heads trying to figure out, well, what do we do? You know, more and more people want to come to the Sunday feast. Should we just have a big pandal out in Cross Maidan and have it there every Sunday? Or nice problem to have to deal with. But anyway, the point being that, you know, Krishna consciousness is doing really, really well in other places. I mean, in India, from what I can understand, Chaupati wasn't the only temple that was doing that. Well, actually, I've got to visit Tirupati, ISKCON Tirupati temple. And it was actually, I got there on a Monday morning, and I was told by the temple president, Revati Raman, that the day before was, I can't remember what it was, you know, some festival day. They had 10,000 people there. They have an incredible setup there, too. They have a beautiful temple right at the base of Tirumala Hill. For those of you who don't know, Tirumala Hill is it's about 3 hours drive from Chennai, it's South India, and on top of that hill is Balaji, and that's Tirupati, that's the famous Balaji Didi. So all year round, there's like, literally now, okay, no exaggeration, there's tens and thousands of people on a regular daily basis that go there, like on a pilgrimage, to see Balaji. This is like here in America, people come out in droves to go to the football game or the whatever, you know, the baseball game or something like that. There, that's what they do. You know, and they go to Tirupati to go see Balaji, and they come in tens of thousands. And some of the people, they actually walk up the hill. It's 4,000 and a half feet above sea level. It's like, you know, a small mountain, basically. Some of them walk up the hill, you know, barefoot. There's no shoes allowed. And they, you know, stand on a line, which will be at least an hour, and sometimes can be as many as like 8 hours. Sometimes you can wait. I had to wait 3.5 hours. I did it. At least I figured I should do it once in my lifetime. And I went with my wife and a couple of the very nice devotees, Suresh. We went down there because he got married down there. We went down for the wedding, and he arranged for some very nice devotees to take us there. And we waited for 3.5 hours in line to see Balaji. One realization I got from that is that we're so fortunate to be in ISKCON because, you know, I was waiting 3.5 hours, and it was hot and it was crowded and like that. And there was, you know, there was really no kirtan. Every now and then somebody would go, some brave person would chant, Govinda, Govinda! You know, and then a few other people would go, Govinda, Govinda! You know, and that would go on for about like a couple minutes or two, and then it would die off, and then, you know, 10, 15 minutes later it would start up again. You know, no real kirtan. So you're waiting for like, you know, anywhere from like an hour to, let's say, 10 hours to see Balaji. And when you get there, you get 30 seconds. That's all you get. Actually, most of the people get about 10, 15 seconds, but the people there could see I was a foreigner. So like after my 10 or 15 seconds, I started to walk off, and they pulled me back, and they gave me another 10, 15 seconds because they knew. They were sensitive to my situation. And I said, oh, that was good. But, you know, that was it. And I was thinking, then, you know, when I got back to Mayapur, we were just standing in front of the Mahapanchatattva deities on Gaur Purnima, and I was going, wow, this is great. You know, Kirtan was ecstatic, and I was thinking we're so fortunate because we can see Rukmini Dwarkadish and Gaur Nitai and Jagannath Baladev Subhadra as much as we want, whenever we want, and have, you know, full kirtan. So it's much better. But anyway, getting back to the point, the Tirupati temple, they're very fortunate. They have 40 full-time book distributors, 40. And where they distribute is they have bookstalls along the Parikram path going up the mountain there. So here's these people, thousands of Indians, they're coming to see Balaji, Govinda, Krishna, you know. And as they're walking up the hill, who do they meet? A bright, smiling-faced Hare Krishna Brahmachari, you know, handing them a Bhagavad Gita. And they do really good. You know, they distribute a lot of books. I was told by the temple president that temple, as I said, which is a big, beautiful temple with a nice guest house, 70% of the money to build that temple came from book distribution. Right? And aside from that, there's like another 100 Brahmacharis living in the temple. And as I said, the day before I got there, he told me they had 10,000 people there for some festival. I can't remember which one it was. But so that's doing really good too. And I just heard reports that, you know, there's a lot of the other temples are doing really good over there. So at least in India, our movement's doing really well. And so point being is that, you know, we could, it's not hopeless. We have to try here. We have to, you know, preach. I think India is a special place. It's, you know, Prabhupada says in one place in the Bhagavad Gita, that unless one has a pessimistic outlook on material life, he has no impetus to make advancement in spiritual life. So they have an advantage over there because it's really easy to have a pessimistic outlook towards material life in India. At least this was for me because, you know, I just couldn't see any opportunity for material enjoyment. It's kind of like the places, you know, even, you know, there is some opulence there in the sense that there are some people who have expensive cars and there are some people who have, you know, live in these big brand new high rise buildings. But like right next to that, there's abject poverty. You know, like, it's, you know, you could, like you have one of these, a beautiful brand new high rise building, but then right next to that, there's some guy living in a little shack with garbage all around. So it's kind of like, you know, opulence and garbage right next to each other. At least for somebody with Western senses, it's hard to really feel very, you know, and it doesn't put you in a mood of material enjoyment. You really get a pessimistic outlook on material life. And everything's so crowded, you know. There's people, like Bombay is huge. Bombay is like the same size as Los Angeles, maybe bigger. And it's just, it's, you know, at any time of the day, cause actually there's about 3 hours or 4 hours a day when it's quiet, which is from about like 3 a.m. till about 7 a.m. And then it's just thousands of people out there, you know. And forget about riding on the trains or anything like that, or buses. Anyway, the point is, I don't see, it's easy for them to have a pessimistic outlook on material life. I would think so anyway, because there's nothing so attractive about the place materially. But therefore, Krishna consciousness is really attractive. It's a hope. It's a hope of some happiness. Because otherwise, it's just karshati, a bit of struggle for existence. They're working really hard, you know, long hours, hard work, and like uncomfortable conditions for what? You know, and people aren't stupid. They're just putting two and two together. They figure, boy, this material, I ain't going to get any happiness in this material life. Let me take the spiritual. Let me try spiritual life. And they do. And anyway, so I think maybe that's part of the reason why our movement's doing so well there, because it's, you know, it's built into the life here that you can easily have a pessimistic outlook towards material life. So anyway, it's doing really well. And what else? What else was a kind of a highlight? Jai Pataka Maharaj is doing a lot better. One of the other nice features of this Chaupati temple is they have a hospital. We have actually, it's the Hare Krishna Hospital. It's about an hour away from the temple. It's called the Bhaktivedanta Hospital. And it's like a, you know, regular hospital. You drive up there, it looks like a hospital and everything. But the only difference is when you go in the front door, the first thing you see is a big murti of Srila Prabhupada, exactly like that. A big Vyasa sign, with Prabhupada on the Vyasa sign, with a Tulsi plant on either side of him. And at least the devotees, when they go in the hospital, they go up, they offer a flower, and they pay dandavats in front of Prabhupada. And like, you know, a very high percentage of the doctors there, like something like 60-80% are devotees. They're initiated disciples of Radhanath Maharaj. And they're really, really nice devotees. You know, ISKCON devotees get the royal treatment when they go there. They really, you know, take care of you nice. I went there and I got like a full checkup and, you know, health checkup and et cetera. And anyway, getting to the point that Jai Pataka Maharaj was there. He was there doing rehabilitation, what's it called, physical therapy. So we saw him there, and he's doing a lot better. He's walking a bit more every day, and he's giving classes. He's already given classes. And he has a little problem, you know, because of the what happened. He's, you know, a little problem speaking, but he's easily understandable, you know. I mean, he feels a little self-conscious. At the beginning of his class, he says, he talks a little bit, and he says, so would you all like me to just speak, or do you want me to speak and have somebody translate, you know, kind of like, not translate, but just kind of repeat it in English again, so make it easy for you to understand. Because, you know, he just wanted to give everybody, prepare everybody. This is the best I can speak. So what do we, and everybody goes, no, we can understand you. Don't worry. Just go ahead. So he just spoke. And mentally, it was the same. You know, it was just like listening to one of his classes, you know, before anything happened. But just as I said, a little bit of a speech impediment there. And before I even left Mumbai, he had already gone. He'd gone down. Every year he does his Ganga Safari or the safari thing. So, this year they kind of tapered it down a little bit. But he went down to Tirupati with a big group of devotees. And then from there he went to Mayapur. And the day after tomorrow, they're celebrating his Vyas Puja there. So he's doing really well. And I heard somebody told me that he even has plans to go to Atlanta a little bit later in this now, about a month or so from now, for the Panihati Festival. So amazing. Miraculously, he's doing pretty, pretty good. And one of the doctors there told me that it's even a miracle that he's still alive, because he didn't just have a stroke. He had like hemorrhaging of the brain stem. And generally speaking, like, people don't live through that. So not only did he live through that, but he's practically about, I'd say, about 60-70% back in action. So that's, you know, was pretty amazing to see and encouraging to see. And they had a special program at the hospital just before a couple of days before he left. Radhanath Maharaj was there, and all the devotees, what it was the disciples of Jai Pataka Maharaj wanted to specially thank all the staff there, which is all these disciples of Radhanath Maharaj for looking after, going above and beyond, because they really all did. They went above and beyond the call of duty to try to, you know, help Jai Pataka Maharaj in every different way they possibly could. So the disciples of Jai Pataka Maharaj put on a special program where they called each one of them up and they gave them a special present, and they just, you know, they described to everybody else who was there what these different individuals did to try to help Jai Pataka Maharaj while he was there, and, you know, everybody was applauding and like that, and that was very nice. So anyway, that's the class, and that's the trip. Anybody have any questions about anything? Boo. Oh, while he's getting the mic from Makhanlal Prabhu and formerly Bhakta Antonio, who's now Ananda Vilas, is it? Ananda Vilas, they both asked me to offer their obeisances to all the devotees here in New Dwarka. They were, you know, they asked me about 3 or 4 or 5 times like that each, so they offer their obeisances. They haven't forgotten New Dwarka. So, question.
Okay, so you've explained sort of one possible reason why ISKCON is more successful in India as opposed to the West. But how do you account for the fact that ISKCON began in the West? Rather quickly, actually. I mean, I was here in the early days. There were hundreds of devotees here.
Well, I don't know if I can give you like a real...
It was just almost like Jaipati, actually.
I could tell you what happened. I mean, Prabhupada did try initially in India. You know, we tried in a place called Jhansi and on an individual level... I guess that's confirmation. but Prabhupada, you know, didn't get a lot of big response in India when he was preaching there initially. And aside from that, he did get the instruction from a spiritual master that, you know, the same instruction which he received on his very first meeting, he got that instruction again in a letter that he received from a spiritual master just shortly before he departed. Bhaktisiddhanta departed from this world, which was that, you know, you're an educated young man. I want you to become a good preacher in the English language and preach in the Western countries, you know, the English-speaking countries. So that's what Prabhupada did. He, you know, tried to execute the instruction of the spiritual master, and Krishna reciprocated, and things started happening here. So, but also it was Prabhupada's desire that, you know, he wanted to use that, you know, his success here in America to try to go back and inspire India, which is what he did. And he didn't get to see it happening in a big, big way while he was here, you know, physically, but... I guess it's just all part of the continuation of Krishna fulfilling Prabhupada's desires. If, you know, he got to see the spreading in the West while he was here, but I don't know. I don't know what is the internal explanation for that. I don't know, but it's nice. It's a nice. I mean, the same thing. We didn't see, you know, very much happening in the Soviet Union and a lot of the Eastern European countries while Prabhupada was around, but now they're doing great there too. You know, I was told by devotees who I met at the Mayapur Festival that they have big numbers over there too. So, I don't know the internal explanation. I don't understand why Krishna's doing it like that. Why we're having a little bit of a tough time here in America, and you know, they're doing so well in these other places, but we don't look a gift horse in the mouth, so to speak. And we'll do better here in America too. We just got to apply ourselves a little bit more. Okay, thank you very much. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.